So it is 5 o'clock on Tuesday. You are listening to KDVS 90.3. And before we begin office hours, I want to remind you that the views that are presented in this show do not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. So this is Professor J, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. Here as always on Tuesday at 5, we're going to knock on someone's door and find out what's going on in all these buildings here on campus. What are people doing? What are they thinking about? What kind of research are they doing? How can they help lead us into a better future full of fun and glory? So here, can you hear me? Okay, there I go. I'm knocking on the door. And I'm very excited today because I think this is going to be quite interesting and educational for all of us. I'm knocking on the door of Ed Taylor from the Agriculture and Resource Economics Department, slightly longer title than most departments.
It's a mouthful.
It's a mouthful. So welcome to the show, Ed.
Thanks, Naomi. It's great to be on your show.
And we're going to be talking about refugees, economics. Does economics make sense? How do we deal with migrant labor? How do we make sense of the place that California is in the economic world today and also the broader world? Because certainly refugees are on everybody's minds, and the economic impact of migration and refugees is really, I think, a central question for us. So, but before we get started on our particular papers he's going to be talking about applied economics and refugees, we always start off with the same question, which is we want to understand how people grow up to be researchers. What happens to them? I imagine you have some kind of interest both in economics, but also maybe some interest in the application of economics. How do you end up in agriculture and resource economics?
Well, when I started college at UC Riverside, I had no idea what I wanted to be.
Okay.
So I dappled in comparative literature, Spanish, ended up in political science. And then when I was a junior, there was a grad student in our department, in the poli-sci department at UC Riverside, who was working, doing his thesis work in Costa Rica, little Central American country. And he called up his advisor and said, you know, if there's an undergrad who wants to come down here, we can set him up with an internship with the National Planning Office. So I went down there. Ron Chilcote was my prof in poli-sci, who hooked me up with this, and I got a little bit of a fellowship from UC, President's Fellowship, to go down there. And I thought, what the heck, you know, give this a try, see what it's about. So here I was in Central America, never been down there before, right? Poli-sci, trying to make sense of the world. And while I was there, I mean, poli-sci is great. You understand a lot of things if you understand political science, but man, a lot of it was economics. And I had never taken an econ class.
You hadn't even taken one.
Never. So. And so when I got back from that year abroad, I had about, what, 5-6 quarters to get my econ degree. So I double majored in econ political science, and in the end graduated an econ major, and there it was, never turned back.
I'm quite struck by the number of people who come on the show who have amazing experiences abroad. So I just want to take a moment to say, to tell our listening students to go away, okay?
Absolutely.
Go away and go out there, because sometimes you don't find issues. Issues find you when you get out into the world, because you were not an economics major at that point.
I was not.
You were not. But simply the experience of going out there and seeing what goes on and then going home and deciding, I want to understand this.
And it's been the same ever since. The world changes me all the time. Every time I go out there, I come home thinking differently.
Mm-hmm. So do you do a lot? It's hard for me to tell from the research papers that I read how much you are actually out in the field doing research and how much you are can study things from the safety and security of our campus. So maybe you want to talk a little bit about that. Are you doing a lot of traveling for these studies?
I'm doing a lot of traveling. It used to be travel to Mexico when I was focused mostly on that country. Did a lot of data collection down there, ran surveys, even a national rural household survey, 3 rounds in Mexico, which gave us an amazing data set to study one of the topics we'll talk about later on, the farm labor topics. Central America, Galapagos Islands, all of these involved running surveys and things. And now it's Africa. Because that's what everybody's looking at. And that's where some of the really big questions like these refugee questions have been coming up. There's so many refugees now. ending up in African countries like Rwanda and Uganda.
Mm-hmm. So your kind of study combines trips out to actually ask questions and try to find out what's going on in the economic world out there. It's a kind of like an eternal repetition of your experience going off to Costa Rica.
Well, when I was in Costa Rica, I didn't collect my own data at all. I worked with the data that the National Planning Office had. What I really love doing, though, is getting out into the field, designing surveys, getting UC Davis students out into the field. I mean, all of these surveys involve, I mean, really mostly it's our graduate students who are going out into the field, and we are training teams of enumerators from the countries how to do these surveys. We're putting the surveys on tablets now, so you can do your interview. Interview might last for an hour, a couple hours. At the end of the interview, you upload the data, and it doesn't matter where you are in the world. You can go to the website and watch the data come in from these surveys and even begin analyzing the data a little bit. So to be out there in the field with your grad students and with a team of enumerators from these countries, I mean, it's very exciting. Everybody yeah. gets to know each other and has – it's hard work. It's really hard work. But, you know, you pull through, and at the end of it all – you just sort of look at each other and say, wow, what have we done here?
Okay, so there's an ad. Anybody wants to go out and have a life-changing experience? Okay, we always have links to your website, a place next to the interview in their archive, so you can get in touch with Professor Taylor and find out about having that. Who knows, maybe it'll be like his life. You'll go out there and you'll never come home. You'll just become the researcher there. So let's turn a little bit and talk to some of the specific things that you find when you go out there and you go to, in this case, about Africa, and you study. I thought this was a fascinating study. The title is Refugees Can Bolster a Region's Economy. So it's a very positive title. And this was published in the Harvard Business Review. And your argument here is that Congolese refugees in Rwanda generate more income than the support that they receive. This seems a little bit like magical economics. So you have to explain that to us. So first, maybe tell us, what is the income that they get? A refugee gets income from where?
So these were refugees from DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo. Mm-hmm. They had just stunning life histories when they would tell you their stories. I mean, just devastating stories. Here, you know, they where can they go? They leave their country. They cross the border. These in particular cross the border into Rwanda next door. Now, Rwanda was the country where the terrible genocide happened
yes.
just a couple of decades ago.
Yes.
And now Rwanda is the country where refugees go in this part of Africa. Hmm. It's an entirely new world out there. And they've made enormous strides in Rwanda. So the United Nations World Food Program read a book that I had written on how to understand impacts of things, all kinds of things, policies, environmental shocks, market shocks, migration, all of these different in local economies. And this is all from, you know, over the years as I studied economics, I did what most economists do. I studied individual economic actors like, you know, firms, households, different household groups, individuals, and how they respond to different shocks, you know, how they're impacted by policies and things. But what always fascinated me weren't the individuals so much as the spaces between them, the connections between them,
mm-hmm.
because we're all connected with each other, right? And if something happens to me, like my crop fails, or like a government program helps me out by putting cash in my pocket if I'm a poor household or something like that, I end up affecting others around me in the way I spend the cash. Do or don't spend it, right?
Right.
But, I mean, if you're talking about a poverty program and I'm a poor household and you come to me and you give me cash, right, which many poverty programs around the world are doing now. They're mm-hmm. they're handing cash usually to women who are very smarter than men about how to use the cash, right? And so you give the cash to the poor woman. It might be conditional on her kids going to school or whatever, but in any event, you give her the cash. And she immediately spends it, right?
Right?
So the minute she spends it, well, who's she buying from? Who's she buying the food from? Now the farmer is benefiting from mm-hmm, it or the little store that sold the thing or whatever it is. Now they have more income too. They turn around. What do they do with their income? They spend it too. Who do they buy from? And you can see how this thing kind of takes off. And you can end up with these multipliers
mm-hmm.
spreading through these local economies. And the great thing about this is that if you can go out there and model and document these multiplier effects of, say, government programs, poverty programs in local economies, and present these results and show that every dollar you put into the hands of a poor person ends up creating, say, $2 of income growth in this local economy. Mm-hmm. Once you add up all the ripples, ripple effects of this program, right? You tell that to, when the first time I shared this with the director of a social welfare program in a country, he took this number. In this particular country, this was in Zambia, we found the child grants program, for every dollar they put in, they ended up creating about $1.80 of income growth in these villages where the poor people lived. And he jumped up and he said, $1 creates $1.80. He said, that's a number I can take to the finance minister, right? Because, you know, these ministries are always battling it out over who gets the money to spend on their programs. Mm-hmm. And if you're a social welfare ministry, the finance minister is going to be saying, well, you know, if we give you money, we could be investing that money to help the economy grow, right?
Okay.
Help,
So where we started off with was the question of who the money comes from. And what you're saying is, in some cases, it's governments that are giving these subsidies, and that what they turned to you for was guidance on how to do this in a way that leads to economic growth.
Exactly. So I've devoted a lot of years to building ways to model these impacts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it came out in this book, and now we can get back to refugees, right? Because this is how life goes. You know, you take these paths and you never know where they're going to take you at the end. So I got a call from the World Food Program, the person in charge of cash transfers and refugee programs in Eastern Africa. He said, Ed, I read your book. You don't know who I am, but I read your book. I'm wondering if this method could be used to understand how refugees and refugee settlements affect host country economies around these refugee camps.
So you're moving it from programs to the poor to programs for refugees, and you're testing the same hypothesis.
Yeah. Your model's all different, but you still have to do your surveys of refugee households and businesses inside the camp, and then of host country households and businesses out to we drew a circle out at 10 kilometers around the camps. So you have this donut-shaped area around the camps where you're doing these household surveys and business surveys of the host country. And then you put the data all together to build the model to then be able to estimate the impact of an additional refugee or of an additional dollar of World Food Program food aid, cash support for refugees in these camps and so forth. And we found that the impact of an additional dollar of food aid to refugees in these refugee camps was on the local economy, it was actually bigger than the dollar that was given to the refugees. Right.
That, same thing with the poverty programs, that the money accrues value because it's used in a very economically growthy way. Is that how you would
say
it?
Totally, economically growthy. I like that. I mean, that's a very, very technical jargon, you know.
But okay. You're talking to someone who studies comparative religion, so
yeah.
I'm following as best as I can.
But I mean, like in Rwanda, you know, it's a great place to study this because Rwanda's refugee policies are among the best in the world. Refugees come into these camps. We had no idea what to expect when we went to these refugee settlements. I mean, I had never been to one.
Mm-hmm.
So we go inside the settlement, and I see people who have gone through unthinkable conditions back home because of civil wars all around them. And they were mostly women. There were a lot of children in the camp who had gone there with their mothers. There were some men, but really it was largely women. And I saw people building new lives inside a refugee camp. I mean, you know, this was really, my gosh, testimony to the human spirit, right?
Yes.
I saw people, refugees trying to create businesses inside these camps.
Mm-hmm.
The first day I was there, there was a wedding. A Congolese man and woman in the refugee camp, both refugees, were there. They were getting married. And actually, I became the photographer that first afternoon because I happened to have a camera. And I said, let me take pictures and I'll give you copies of these things. And so, you know, these are people who are rebuilding their lives. And under Rwanda's laws, refugees can come and go. They can leave the camp at will. They can visit local markets. They can even work for host country farms and businesses if they want to.
Mm-hmm.
So the host country folks can't go into the refugee camp, but the refugees can leave the camp and go into the local economy. And it used to be that the UN World Food Program would just hand food to the refugees in these camps.
Exactly.
But now they're switching. They give them cell phones and they transfer cash onto those cell phones once a month. And then the refugees can cash out or they can buy stuff with their cell phones. They can go into the local markets outside the camps. And now the local vendors and the farmers and everybody is benefiting from these refugee programs.
So, but how do you explain in that economic growth part, how is it that the dollar becomes more than a dollar in its use? Just explain, if you were trying to explain that to somebody who was not with, who wasn't necessarily a lot of economic training, how do you explain the growth factor, which seems fairly large in these cases? I guess part of it would be that they don't put it in the bank in a savings account and never touch it, that it's partly because it's circulating.
That's right. It's all about circulation.
Yes.
You know, we've known about this for a long time, multipliers. There was a famous economist named Keynes,
right,
who influenced the Great Depression policies and basically said to get out of the Depression, the government should just pay people to build anything, whatever it is, right, to do anything,
right,
walls, build it, public works projects, the WPA program, all of that. Because if you put money in people's hands, they will spend it, and that will create income for other people too.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're looking at a multiplier within a village, or say within the host country economy around a refugee camp, okay, you give a dollar to a refugee. The refugee then, what does he do with it or she do with it? She takes the dollar into a local market, say, and spends that buying food. Now the vendor has made a dollar off that, right? So what does the vendor do with that dollar? Well, the vendor has costs and things, so the vendor's income off that is a little bit less. But the vendor then, say, buys a TV set. Well, now it's left the local economy, has no more impact, but it has some impact wherever the TV set was made.
Comes
right?
from, exactly.
But if the vendor is using part of that money to buy food from a farmer then, for example, now the farmer has more income. And,
right,
you know, you can actually add up these bits of income increases all along the chain.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And what you get at the end is something bigger than what went in at the beginning.
So all so refugees are now the Keynesians, all the refugee
yeah,
organizations.
That's
become,
right. They're sold on.
Right. So you talk about two factors that are important if a government or a group wants to help a refugee. One is you do say this to give cash and not food, because, again, the food isn't going to circulate and accrue in the same way the cash is. And the second point you make is to promote long-term integration. So the idea is that when these refugees come, they're probably not going to go home, and that you have to look at them as people who you want to invest in, because at some point they're going to become citizens. I'm curious, do you think that is true in most of the cases? I was wondering if there was anything that was special about this case that you were looking at, because it seems like this is a case where they're quite open to the refugees integrating into the culture. But that, I imagine, is not always true.
No, it's definitely not true. Rwanda is very unique in this way. Uganda next door is also very unique.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they're even giving plots of land to refugees.
Oh, fascinating.
Who can start farming the land. They allow the refugees to come and go. By integrating with the local economy, the refugees are able to create these income multipliers. They're able to make a living for themselves too. Their income then goes up. They spend that income and so forth. And so, you know, you can easily have a situation where the host country economy benefits because the refugee is there and integrating with the local economy. Now, looking around the world, there are some refugee camps that are not like that,
yeah,
that are closed off. They're fenced off. Refugees can't come and go. They're given food inside the camp by international donors, UN agencies and things. But, you know, some countries don't have this open policy that
mm-hmm.
promotes integration of refugees with their local populations.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's this kind of sense that, well, look, it's temporary. The refugees are only here for a while. So let's imagine that they're here for a while. They're going to go home. They don't need to integrate with our population. And there might even be resentment. There might be discrimination in the
mm-hmm.
host country population that, you know, that supports this policy of kind of almost caging off refugees from the rest of the population. But when that happens, you can't see the economic benefits.
Mm-hmm. So that's to the detriment of the host countries there.
Yes.
But I imagine it's quite a hard sell to explain to people that they're going to, or maybe what you're telling us is it's an easier sell than I think. To tell people that caging off and trying to isolate refugees is going to exacerbate the problems, and that integrating them is going to help everybody. I imagine that just must be a difficult argument to make. I'm curious, is there some way in which this is made in Rwanda, or is it just not made? It's just simply because of the kinds of policies they have that they don't actually have to inculcate any kind of attitude towards the refugee.
Well, you know, we talked about that out in the field, and I talked about it with Rwandans too. What is it about you guys?
Yes.
You know, that you're welcoming refugees with open arms. And other countries don't. And the same in Uganda, because Uganda definitely is the same way. And, you know, among the answers that we got, some of the more interesting ones were what was that, you know, look, we know what it's like to be a refugee.
Yeah.
Right? Because it happened to us. And these are our neighbors. Mm-hmm. We need to be there for them. We need to take them in. And then along the way, you know, decisions have to be made about, okay, where does the refugee camp go, right? And you would think, well, not in my backyard. But in Uganda, localities are actually competing to get the next refugee camp the same way that communities in California competed to get the next UC campus when UC Merced popped up.
And we're just like a group of refugees, right, taking these refugee students, right?
Yeah, there you go. Because they've seen it. They've seen the benefits that that their communities can get if mm-hmm. there's a refugee settlement there, and the refugees come in with, you know, various amounts of money. Some of them have some money when they come in. Mm-hmm. Some of them get help from family members who will send money to them. And then they're getting assistance from these, say, the World Food Program, UNHCR, you know, these agencies that are supporting refugees. And so the host country community realizes that if they do this right, you know, they can do well by doing good in a way, right? They can welcome the refugees with open arms, and they can allow them to integrate with their communities and become part of their economies, and they can create benefits as a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean everybody benefits. Of course, you know, I mean, you could imagine that there are some workers out there, you know, say
yes.
a few farm workers or a few workers in stores or whatever, who might find themselves competing with refugees. I mean, depending upon what the local economy looks like.
Right.
And so that's why we really looked hard at what the local economy looks like, what kinds of connections refugees can make with local economies. And in Rwanda, we found that the place where the biggest benefits came about was a relatively rich agricultural area, where when the refugees spent their cash on, it's almost overwhelmingly on food, right? Mostly yeah. That's what they're spending their money on. There were local farms that were able to produce more food and benefit from this refugee spending.
So that's a good symbiotic relationship. You want the refugee camp to be in a place where people can make use of the fact that there are now more people eating. Exactly.
I mean,
those ways.
It's logical,
yes,
right?
Yes, that
know,
makes a lot of sense.
If you put something somewhere, you want to put it in a place where these synergies
right.
can happen.
It's always reassuring when economics is a little bit, makes a little bit of sense like right. that. I imagine it's quite difficult in my mind to jump to America, but I'm curious if you think there are lessons that you could learn from your experience, applying them to the agricultural economic issues that we face in America, and also just the attitude we have towards refugees, which seems so diametrically opposed to everything we're talking about today. It's quite striking. You know, is there a message of that we can say about the economic growth being connected to letting people in that you think would resonate at all in America?
In this political climate, that's, you know, it's a tough question. I mean, unfortunately, refugees, like immigrants, can easily become scapegoats, right?
Yes.
By people who want political gain from that. And we've certainly seen that happen. I mean, not just over recent years, over centuries in the United States, different refugee groups immigrant groups have been discriminated against. But many economic studies have been done about what happens to immigrants and what happens to refugees once they're here and what their impact is on the economy of the United States. Overwhelmingly, those studies paint very optimistic pictures about the impacts of immigration and the impacts of refugee migration into the United States. High-income countries, I mean, the refugees who come here are instantly integrated because they're part of the economy. They aren't they aren't cordoned off in camps, right? They're integrated instantly with our economy. And the studies that have been done show very convincingly that Taking in refugees can create big economic benefits, and especially in a country where we're very high employment, right? There are a lot of job possibilities out there. We have a changing age distribution in our population. And when we look at something like agricultural work, I mean, who wants to go out and pick crops for a wage? It's as countries get rich, people growing up in those countries don't even imagine themselves doing hired farm work anymore.
Right. So there's a good news, bad news. The good news is that a whole lot of economic studies have supported your kind of work and have shown that the economic advantage of taking in refugees. And the good news also is that you have very fairly specific policy recommendations that will help that work well. The bad news is it doesn't seem to care. People don't necessarily care about all the good news you're bringing because it only has sort of saliency in a certain type of environment. In other words, I do wonder whether or not if we led more with those kinds of arguments, if they had a little bit more, I don't know, even just in the sense of you seeing them more in the press in places, that people would be at least aware of the fact that that association in their mind between a refugee and economic development, there's some kind of possibility. Do you know whether there's any way in which that, do you map sort of what happens with your studies? You had the wonderful example of somebody reading the book who's a high up person, a kind of direct route to power. Do you think there's also sort of a more indirect route to power through your studies by just sort of keeping to beat the drum out there about the positive economic impact of refugees?
Well, when I look around at the impact that our research on refugees has had, it's been big in Africa.
Yes.
And it's been big within the UN agencies. And that's a big advantage of doing this research in coordination with the World Food Program.
Uh-huh.
They made sure that our first paper came out in a major science journal, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and then Harvard Business Review picked it up. And the World Food Program, of course, was just handing that to everybody in the world at all their international conferences and things.
Mm-hmm.
It went, you know, straight to the desks of presidents in Africa. And so the impact that this study had, I think, on countries in Africa willingness to take in refugees has been big. And that isn't a small thing because most of the world's refugees by far are not in rich countries. They're in low-income countries that border conflict zones, which are other low-income countries, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you look at a country like Uganda, which has taken in upwards of 1 million refugees from South Sudan. I mean, that's a tiny country. And compare that to how many refugees the United States takes in
each year. Okay, so we're now the example to live down on all of this. I think that is a wonderful point before we come to our first break to just point out that sometimes when you do a study and you make this economic argument and you go out and you get it on the right desks, it actually has a big impact. Maybe not yet in America, but out in the rest of the world, people are thinking a lot about how to use and foster the idea of refugees as being part of the economic growth of a country. So at this point, we've reached the first half, the end of the first half of our first segment. So we will be back with Ed Taylor from the Agricultural and Resource Economics Department and talk more about refugees in just a minute. So stay with us. So we are back now. This is Professor Jay for the second half of Office Hour today with Ed Taylor from the Agriculture and Resource Economics Department. And the first half of the show, we were talking about the impact of refugees in Africa. And for the second half, we're going to move a little closer to home because Ed has also done a number of studies about agricultural workers in California. That's certainly closer to home than refugees in Rwanda. And this study called Can Wages Rise Quickly Enough to Keep Workers in the Field? I found there were many surprising points just to somebody who's lived in California for many years and is aware of these issues. But I was quite struck by the point you make that the number of available workers is declining and that that's kind of the background against we who live in California and eat fruits and vegetables have to be thinking about the fact that there are fewer people who want to work in the field. I think it's partly you're saying because in Mexico itself, there is an increase in education and people have other opportunities. So how can we kind of get a sense? Are we talking about a lot less workers coming or can you sort of help us sort of map that trend?
Well, first, quickly, the setting. In the middle of the 1900s, you could still find a number of workers in agriculture who had been born and raised in the United States.
Okay.
But, you know, by the time I was growing up, and I won't tell you how old I am, I didn't know anybody who aspired to be a hired farm worker. I had a few friends who imagined themselves being like organic farmers,
right.
Owner-operators.
Plenty of those around
right.
here.
But to go out and pick crops for a wage, that just wasn't on people's radar. That wasn't why we went to school, studied, you know, that wasn't happening. And that happened all around the U.S. So U.S. People in the U.S. stopped growing up to be farm workers pretty much. I mean, there were a few, but not very many. But right next door, we had Mexico,
right.
where there were lots of kids growing up. And they couldn't imagine doing much else than agricultural work. I mean, they grew up on their little family farms in villages, maybe growing the milpa, the maize and beans and
they
squash.
They were agricultural. Their farmers were.
They were.
Right.
They knew how to do it. And when they had the opportunity to come and work in the United States at farm jobs, making in an hour what you would make in rural Mexico in a day, if you had a job in rural Mexico that paid at all, they did it. So there were plenty of people in Mexico who were more than willing to come up and do farm work in the United States. Now, we had a formal program for a while under which you could do that legally, the Bracero program, but that ended in 1964. And after that, really the only way to come up here and do farm work, say on a farm in the Central Valley in California, was to cross the border illegally and to do farm work as an unauthorized migrant in the U.S. There just really wasn't another way to do it. And so farmers in California and other parts of the country began to rely more and more on a workforce that was not only foreign, but was also unauthorized, right?
Right. And this you're saying this is by the 60s, this shift had taken place?
Big time.
Big time, right.
Big time by the 60s. And so you get into the 60s, 70s, 80s. I mean, in the Western U.S., we never had a ton of domestic agricultural labor,
exactly.
right?
Right.
So as our agricultural expanded, like after the Transcontinental Railroad went in, we could grow crops and sell them to cities on the East Coast. We had to get our labor somewhere. It was always from different immigrant groups. Hmm. I mean, it was first the Chinese
right.
who had been working on the railroad, then the Japanese. There was a wave of Indian migration. I mean, it was always foreign, with one exception, and that's Steinbeck's year, you know, the Grapes of Wrath years, the Dust Bowl, which sent very large numbers of people west from the Dust Bowl states. It took a major climatic event to make this happen.
And you can't count on that happening all the time.
Yeah, you sure don't want it to either.
Exactly,
yeah.
right.
But, I mean, remarkably, the California farm workforce suddenly turned from being largely immigrant to mostly domestic workers. But these were people who were born and raised in the heartland of the U.S. and who just lost everything because of the Dust Bowl. It was an absolutely stunning event. So, but then after that, World War II came around. People got pulled out of the fields again to go off as part of the war effort, as soldiers working in factories, and so you know that's when we had the Bracero program that brought farm workers in from Mexico up until 1964, and then after that, it was all pretty much a Mexican farm workforce here in California. So Mexico saved the day, but what our research has found is that kids in rural Mexico aren't growing up to be farm workers anymore the mm-hmm. way they were before.
Oh.
And so the first thing we found was that the probability of doing farm work is going down by about 1% a year in rural Mexico.
1% a year.
And that adds up to about 150,000 fewer farm workers coming out of rural Mexico every year. 150,000. U.S. and Mexican farmers have to compete for that smaller and smaller number of farm workers, that smaller farm workforce. And that's where we find ourselves now.
Mm-hmm. So what are we going to do then in this case? You recommend that one thing to do is to raise wages. That makes sense. In other words, when you have a smaller number of workers, you have to pay the migrants more in order to get them to work in the field. And the other thing you recommend is mechanization of the harvesting so that you don't need this many workers. Because now you can do it by machine. And you point out that some harvesting is already done by machine, but some is not.
Yeah.
So how would you balance those two? In other words, they seem to me to be sort of to have different targets than. So maybe there's some crops that we're never going to be able to mechanize as because of just the nature of the crop, and we're always going to need some workers. So we should be planning on paying higher wages to get more of those fewer workers to come and pick our fruit or whatever.
Yeah, well, I mean, we don't have to sit here and urge farmers to pay higher wages. They're paying higher wages. It's happening. Farm wages, finally. I mean, this hasn't happened for a very long time. They are going up, and they're going up very, very sharply. And that's a reflection of these farm labor shortages.
Huh.
And so, and farmers are complaining that they can't get the workers they need to harvest crops. Of course, they always complained that, right?
Right.
And so that's why, you know, when we did this research and started sharing it with farmer organizations and things, the first question the farmers asked was, well, is this temporary? Will the workers come back? And so then we extended our research to find out why this was happening in Mexico. And it turns out, I mean, families are smaller. Did you know that the average Mexican woman has about as many kids now as the average U.S. woman?
Which is a big
drop.
Fertility
rates are about the same. Right. Big drop, around 2 kids per woman, right?
Right.
Mexico's a little over, U.S. is a little under, but, you know, we're
much
right
closer.
In the same ballpark, right? The average rural Mexican my age has about 5 years of education, a little less, not even primary. And the average rural Mexican my kid's age has 9.5 years of education.
Wow.
Nothing takes someone, a kid, out of the field more quickly than a little bit of schooling, right?
Right.
And then the non-farm economy in Mexico is growing. New jobs are being created for the kids who are getting more education out in the villages so they can move to the Toyota factory or whatever it is and get a job there. So, no, they're not coming back, right? And so what are farmers' options? Well, there are really three. One option is farmers could stop growing the crops that demand so much labor.
I didn't mention that one, which is that you just stop doing the growing.
Right. And some are. I mean, there are, we just did a study that found that some farmers have stopped growing putting as many acres into labor-intensive fruit and vegetable crops, and they've switched land over to say, nut tree crops.
Something that's
easier. Takes no labor at all.
Right.
They have shake and catch machines. They shake the dickens out of the tree and the nuts fall onto a net. Almost no labor there, right? But, I mean, we can only eat so many almonds, right? We still want fresh fruits and vegetables. How much are you willing to pay for a fresh organic peach that's handpicked in California?
Don't even ask.
Right.
It's a lot.
And it isn't just us. Ask someone in Japan what they're willing to pay or for a fresh picked organic strawberry from California, that California name. The demand is still there. People are still willing to pay for this. And as our incomes go up, we're demanding more and more of these fresh fruits and vegetables. And so are Mexicans. I mean, as Mexico's income goes up, I mean, their per capita income is up around $20,000 a year, adjusted for cost of living. So, you know, they're demanding more. We're all demanding more. So just not growing those crops isn't a solution here or in Mexico, actually.
Right.
So what else can you do? You can try to find new workers in new places, right? So people say, well, can we go to other parts of Mexico? No, our study covered all of Mexico.
It's over.
Right.
Mexico is over, guys.
Mexico is over. The trend is negative, even in the southern states of Mexico. Could you go to Guatemala? Well, Guatemala is a lot smaller than Mexico. It's becoming urbanized, too. And Mexico, while it's sending fewer workers to pick crops in the U.S., it's starting to import workers from
Guatemala.
In fact, they've got a guest worker program now with Guatemala and Mexico. So
then we went to rising wages, giving people more money.
Yeah, so wages are going up because they have to. You know,
right.
You have to pay higher wages or else workers just aren't going to come and pick your crop, right? So with wages going up, suddenly it becomes more feasible to think about, okay, using new technologies that might let us grow more food with fewer people. So how do you do that? Well, some crops and some tasks are much easier to mechanize than others are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
For example, raisin grapes. You know, it used to be the most labor-intensive thing that happened in North America, that workers would go out to do the Fresno raisin grape harvest. They'd have to hand cut the grapes, lay them out on paper trays on the ground to dry in the sun. And then after they dried, they'd have to go back out again, roll up the trays and so forth. But now with this new dry on the vine technology, they can grow the raisin grapes on trellises over the field. When they're ready to start drying them, they just go down the rows with a tractor that has a blade that just severs
them all off.
It just severs the stems. And so there's almost no labor anymore with that. And so that's an example of one that you can mechanize pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
Teaching a machine how to go out and figure out which strawberry is ripe and ready to be picked,
pick only those,
and do it delicately and set strawberry into a box.
Let us know. Are you working with teams at Davis? Is there a team at Davis that's trying to figure out how to pick, how to teach a machine to recognize a ripe strawberry.
Davis is at the forefront of developing many of these new technologies, which are, you know, it isn't a machine anymore. It's much more than that. It's a machine. It's a computer. It's thinking. You're using artificial intelligence and machine learning. You're using optics that, you know, can, because you have to see the fruit. You have to figure out. Mm-hmm. You're even redesigning the fields. Right? And the orchards.
Makes sense.
Like to harvest apples with these new technologies. They are reconfiguring the apple orchards so the apples grow in two dimensions instead of three. You train the trees to grow, you know, to be very skinny and tall and flat. So it's like a wall of apples.
So it's easier to harvest them. So once again, I wonder, what do you think are the lessons you want us to draw from what you've learned here? Obviously, migrant workers is such a hot issue. It's almost hard to translate this entire conversation we're having to the actual conversation that people are having about immigrant labor in California. So I don't know, how would you try to help an average Californian kind of understand the shift that we're involved in and what implications that has and how to help them make sense of the world of immigrants we live in?
Well, I guess what I would say is that, you know, we rely entirely on immigrant labor for the fresh fruits and vegetables that we eat here in California. Without the immigrant labor right now, we can't do it. The labor supply is going down because in other countries that are getting richer, kids aren't growing up to be farm workers anymore like before. When you hear farmers complaining that they don't have enough farm workers, believe them, it's happening. Farm wages are going up. That's good for workers. That's good for rural communities. It's really a hard time to be a farmer right now, though. We have to develop new technologies that can allow our workers to be more productive so you can grow more food with fewer workers. That makes it possible for farmers to pay workers higher salaries. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff here that could happen if we do it right. But it's really a race for technology to come up with new methods quickly enough, right, before the farm workforce dwindles too much more.
Well, let's say you were going to have your policy to go to the office, as you said, to the desk of the president. What would your policy recommendation be for dealing with migrant labor in California?
Well, so many farmers and farm associations still think that if we just had opened up the borders, you know, put a little door in Trump's wall at the border so that farm workers can keep coming through from Mexico, have a guest worker program that would bring in lots of farm workers from Mexico, that would solve the problem. But, you know, at best, that's a stopgap short-term solution, because if the kids aren't growing up to be farm workers on the other side of that wall in Mexico, letting them come in doesn't solve your problem, right?
Okay.
And so immigration policy isn't the solution to our farm labor problem anymore.
Okay. That's fighting words there. Okay. You heard it on Office Hour. Okay. So it's going to be technologically driven, and we just need to stop talking about, there may be other reasons to talk about immigration policy, right?
Oh, for sure.
For sure.
Lots of other reasons,
but they're not really, the farmer who's interested in opening up the door, you're saying to him, it's just we live in a shifting world.
It's a stopgap. Maybe you can buy time by convincing Washington to let you bring in a few more workers, or making it easier under the H-2A guest worker program to bring in workers. But it's just buying you time. In the long run, you have to figure out how to grow more crops with fewer workers.
Okay.
And you need technology for
that. So if that's what everybody has to figure out, then maybe we can go to the other issue again, which is like, what is Rwanda, Uganda? One of the things we saw is that they're just more open to refugees in general. So if we don't see immigrants necessarily as solving a work problem, how do we just, again, I'm wondering if you had any advice also in terms of policy. How do we see these people as being a more positive force for something, as opposed to seeing them as just being such a frightening force? How do we diffuse the frightening image of the immigrant? And maybe if it's not economically, you're primarily talking about that, you have brought back the message from the African countries that it partly has to do with identification. People who can see these people as more like themselves. And that argument is ultimately the world in which we have to live in, where people can see people who are different from them or in worse circumstances, running away, frightened or feared or whatever, as being more like them. Is that kind of a too touchy-feely?
I don't know what it means to be like us because we're such a diverse society. And this is something that has always confused me about the backlash against immigration. Our whole history is a history of immigration. That diversity that we have in our society and culture is thanks to immigration over the years. And so it doesn't make sense to not welcome immigrants. And economically, it makes less sense. Of course, I'm speaking more as an economist here in this interview, right? Because that's where I feel more at home. But economically, it doesn't make sense because we don't have the labor to keep fueling our economy in the future. As our birth rates decrease, we rely on immigration to make keep our economy vibrant. And this is actually a big advantage we have over other countries that we're competing with. China in particular does not have that demographic advantage of immigration to help their economy grow down the line. And they're actually facing some very serious demographic constraints down the line, especially with their one child per couple policy, which was only reformed recently. They don't have the young workforce there looking ahead 20, 30, 40 years from now to be able to keep that economy thriving. We do if we keep our doors open to immigrants. And so that's how we have to do it. They're our future.
I mean, that you're making sense and you are talking here as an economist. I did just want to remind our listeners that we heard that interesting moment in the first half in which people in Rwanda were not afraid of refugees because they saw them as being like themselves. We have been through bad times ourselves. Whereas our immigrant experience, I guess what we're saying, we've filed that away. We've filed away the fact that we are all feeling very native right now. Even those of us whose families have not been here that long, we lose touch very quickly with that immigrant experience. So
even those of us who have fascinating family history stories that are about immigration, our ancestors who came over from Europe or China or Japan or wherever it happens to be.
Right. Well, before you go, I want to spend a few minutes talking about your other very interesting project, which is also economics and also applied economics, but has nothing to do with agriculture, which is your starting this rebel text, which was, you said 6 years ago, you started a plan to cut costs for students with the problem of how expensive textbooks are by getting together with colleagues. And I guess sometimes on your own, writing textbooks and then making them available to the students. So this is quite a story, and it's applied economics in a big way right here on campus. So I think I want you to tell us a little bit about it. You wrote textbooks for two of your classes. Is that correct?
That's right. And I blame my children for this.
Aha.
So we were sitting around the dinner table one night, and I had chosen an econometrics textbook for the class that I was about to teach here at UC Davis. And my son was taking his first college class in calculus. And he was complaining that he had had to buy a $250 calculus book. And I said, well, why didn't you get a used one? Because, you know, it wasn't his $250. Of course, it was ours, right? So my wife and I were saying, why didn't you get a used one? And he said, because we have to use the problems in this new edition for all of our problem sets. And so you can't get by with a previous edition, right? You know how it is.
Yes.
These new editions come out, you got to buy the new edition. And profs don't think about how much it's costing their students to buy these textbooks. It's a big problem that we have here in academia. Not very many profs stop and think, my gosh, my students are going to have to cough up, you know, $200 each, $300 bucks each, whatever, for their textbook. So anyway, here we were at the dinner table, and my kids are looking at me saying, you know, Dad, you teach. How do you deal with this? And I said, well, I just ordered up this textbook. How much is it going to be? It's going to be $175, $200. They had me. And so they said, well, Dad, you can't do that. And I said, well, so what do you want me to do, write my own book? And they said, yeah, you've been teaching this stuff for a long time. Go write your own book. It's time for you to do that. But promise us that you will never, ever assign an expensive textbook again in any of your classes at UC Davis. And so your kids are looking at you. You have to say, okay, I promise. And once you promise your kids, you have to do it.
Right.
Right. So next time I taught the class, I began writing up chapter by chapter. I would post them on the web. We didn't have Canvas back then. It was SmartSite or something like that, right, for the students to download. They didn't have to pay anything because they were getting my PDFs of the next chapter I wrote. They would read them. They'd give me great feedback. My UC Davis students were part of the project. right? They were helping me write this textbook while I was teaching these classes. So I did that for econometrics. Then I did that for development economics. My colleague Aaron Smith teamed up with me on the econometrics one. He's a fantastic econometrician. My colleague Travis Libert, who's a fantastic development economist, teamed up with me on the development economics book. And we came up with these books. We self-published them. We made them available to students online for, like, I don't know, $25 or something. They could get them from Amazon or wherever. And then UC Press took notice. And UC Press, they're part of the UC system, right? And so they care about textbook prices. And so they came to me, they came to us, and they said, how about you let us publish these as textbooks? And of course, my first question was, well, how much are you going to charge for these?
Exactly.
By the way, they're better books than the ones that are out there, too, we think. We think
okay,
they're written
so
in a
quality.
Way.
It's not just that they're inexpensive. They're also high quality.
No, my students tell me, you know, so many students have said, this is the first textbook I read cover to cover because, you know, it just reads well. It's concise, no fluff. You know, this is the Google generation, right? You want to find something out, you go and Google it, right? If you're going to write a textbook for that kind of discerning eye, it has to get to the point quickly and not embellish things too much, but bring in nice real-world examples that people can connect with. So, you know, that's what we did. So we negotiated with UC Press to keep the price down and to publish these books. And so now Rebel Text, instead of being a publisher of these alternative textbooks, is kind of an incubator, or it became an incubator where it sort of created these books and then UC Press came in and took them over. So they now have our Essentials of Development Economics book and Essentials of Applied Econometrics book.
Mm-hmm. So maybe out there, you professors, maybe there's nothing you can do about refugees in Rwanda, and maybe there's nothing you can do about farm immigrants, but there is something you can do about applied economics immediately, which is reconsider your high expensive texts that you are, the textbooks you're requiring your students to purchase. I'd like to ask first on this, why do you think faculty pay so little attention to the cost of textbooks? Because I had the exact same experience. It was when my children started to buy textbooks that my husband and I were absolutely shocked at this sort of the racket behind it as well, with constantly having to buy new ones. And it was like, I'd been a professor for many years, but we're all telling stories about learning about it at the dining room table. Is there some vital conversation we're not having at our dining room tables as faculty? And that's why all of these professors charge for these incredibly expensive books. I mean,
you know, it happened at our dining room tables, but it has to happen here in the university community. We have to talk about this and we have to face up to it. And it isn't that professors are bad people, right? It isn't that they intentionally meant to hurt their students by requiring these expensive textbooks. It's that they didn't think about it, you know? Uh-huh. The culture was just not to think about it. You pick these books, the publishers send them to you for free so that you can peruse them and you can choose the book that you think would fit your course the best. And you don't really stop. I never stop to ask, okay, how much is this book going to cost my students? I just pick the book, right?
Okay, well, we're stopping now and we're asking all the faculty to stop and think about the cost of the book. What do they do then? What are the steps that you could walk them through if they pay attention to this? Heaven forbid one of their kids signs up for one of their classes and says, you know, Mom, Dad, I don't want to buy the book for your class. Where do they go from there? This is a fairly ambitious project to end up actually writing your own text. So maybe give us a sense. How much work was this?
A ton. It was a lot of work. I'm not sure I have another one of those in me.
Well, you did two. I did two.
And then when I started teaching the agricultural labor class, there wasn't a book for that. And so my ex-grad student and I wrote a book called The Farm Labor Problem, A Global Perspective. And that just came out. So, I mean, what can you do first? If you're teaching an introductory class that, you know, it's material that isn't like changing every year, you can probably use resources online to assign to your students to get through that. Introductory economics, introductory microeconomics, you know, just, you know, go online with this stuff. I mean, non-economics fields are filled with these things. There's been a project here at UC Davis to provide, you know, free online resources for chemistry classes, for example. It's been a very exciting project. So I think there are a lot of possibilities now in this internet age because the information is out there, right? It's accessible. There's no reason to assign an expensive introductory math book of any kind, probably, right? And so just do it. It might cost you a little more work, though, because you won't have the problems there in the book.
Yes.
And say, go do the even number problems or whatever it is.
It's going to be your time. But I think that's a very useful way to think about it, that we're asking faculty to do right now, not necessarily to commit to everybody writing their own textbooks, but one, to thinking about the issue of textbook cost. And second of all, when possible, use stuff that is available. And that seems to me a totally wonderful message for you to bring, because you study applied economics. So what's more applied economics at Davis than the outrageous cost of the textbooks? But we have come to the end of the show. So I want to thank you very much for coming on the show today. It was very interesting. I learned a lot about, I'm going to think about refugees and how to help everybody see them as economic engines and not some kind of strange people we have to fear. So thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Yeah. And this show will be archived on officehourucdpodcast.com, along with a link to Professor Taylor's studies. If you want to study more, you want to download it because you want to argue with your uncle about the economic impact of immigrants, or maybe you will know a farm grower who's hoping he's going to get more laborers from Mexico. You can bring him the bad news. So go ahead and you can find that. And then next week we will knock on somebody else's door and we will be back with some other insights and ideas. And in the meantime, go forth and think about textbook costs. Okay? Bye.